From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Blue Vase of Ghosts by Tanith Lee. 1. Subrus the Magician. Above the evening sky, dark blue, transparent, and raining stars. Below, the evening-colored land, also blue to the depths of its hills, its river-carven valley, blue to its horizon, where dusting of gold freckles revealed the lights of the city of Vame. Between, a bare hillside with two objects on it, a curious stone pavilion and a frightened man. The cause of the man's fear, evidently, was the pavilion, or what it signified. Nevertheless, he had advanced to the open door and was peering inside. The entire landscape had assumed the romantic air of faint menace that attends twilight, all outlines darkening and melting in the mysterious smoke of dusk. The pavilion appeared no more sinister than everything else, about 8 feet in height, with a flat roof set on 5 walls of rough-hewn slabs. Its only true occult area lay over the square step and through the square door mouth, a matched square of black shadow, until, "I seek the magician, Lord Subrus," the frightened man exclaimed aloud, and the black shadow vanished in an ominous brazen glare. The man gasped, not so much in fear as in uneasy recognition of something unexpected, nor did he cry out, turn, or run, or fall on his knees, when in the middle of the glare there stood an unnatural figure. It was a great toad, large as a dog and made of brass, which parted its jaws with a creaking of metal hinges and asked, "Who seeks Subrus, master of the 10 Menachae? "My name is not important," quavered the man. "My mission is, Lord Subrus is interested in purchasing rarities of magic. I bring him one." Galaxies glinted and wheeled in bulbous amphibian eyes. "Very well," the toad said. "My maker hears. You are invited in. Enter." At which the whole floor of the pavilion rushed upwards, with the monster squatting impassively atop it. Revealed beneath was a sort of metal cage, big enough to contain a man. Into this cage all visitors must step, and the frightened visitor knew as much, just as he had known of the hill, the pavilion, the glare of unseen lamps, and the horrendous brazen guardian. For down the trade roads and throughout the river ports of Vame, word of these wonders had spread, along with the news that Subrus, master of the 10 Menachae, would buy with gold objects of sorcery, providing they were fabulous, bizarre, and preferably unique. The visitor entered the cage, which was the second of the 10 Menachae. The toad being the first, the cage instantly plunged into the hollow hill, his entrails seemingly left plastered to the pavilion roof by the rapid descent. The visitor clutched to himself the leather satchel he had brought, and thought alternately of riches and death. Subrus sat in a chair of green quartz in a hall hung with drapes, the colors of charred roses and black panthers. A clear pink fire burned on the wide hearth that gave off the slight, persuasive scent of strawberries. Subrus studied the fire quietly with deep-lidded dark eyes. He had the face of a beautiful skull, long hands, and a long leopardine body to concur with that image. The robe of murky, murderous crimson threw into exotic relief his luminous and unblemished pallor, and the strange, dull bronze of his long hair that seemed carved rather than combed. When the cage dashed down into the hall and bounced on its cushioned buffers, throwing the occupant all awry, Subrus looked up unsmiling. He regarded the man who staggered from the cage clutching a satchel with none of the cruel, arid expressions or gestures the man had obviously anticipated. Subris's regard was compounded of pity, a vague inquiry, and intense drugged boredom. It was, if anything, worse than sadism and savagery. A melodramatic laugh and a glimpse of wolf fangs would have somehow seemed preferable to those opaque and disenchanted eyes. "Well," Super said, "less a question than a plea. Oh, for the love of the gods, interest me in something." The plea of a man, if he were that alone, to whom other men were insects and their deed pages of a book to be turned, and turned in the vain hope of a quickening. The man with a satchel quailed. "Magician Lord, I had heard you wish marvels to be brought to you that you might acquire them?" Super sighed. "You heard correctly. What then have you brought?" "In this satchel, lordly one, something beyond..." "Beyond what?" Subris's somber eyes widened, but only with disbelief at the tedium this salesman was causing him. "Beyond my wildest dreamings, perhaps you meant to say? I have no wild dreamings. I should welcome them." In a panic, the man with the satchel blurted something, the sort of overplay he might have used on an ordinary customer. It had become a habit with him to attempt startlement in order to gain the upper hand, but not here, where he should have left well alone. "What did you say?" Subris asked. I said, yes, that the Lady Lunaria Vame was wild dream enough. Now the satchel man stood transfixed at his own idiocy, his very bones knocking together in wretched fright. Indeed, Subris had lost his mask of boredom, but it had been replaced merely by an appalling contempt. "Have I become a laughing stock in Vame?" The query was idle, mild. Suddenly the man with the satchel realized the contempt of the magician was self-directed. The man slumped and answered truthfully. "No one would dare laugh, magician lord, at anything of yours. The length of the river, men pale at your name. But the other thing, you can hardly blame them for envying you, the Lady Lunaria." He glanced up. Had he said the right words at last? The magician did not respond. The frightened satchel man had space to brood on the story when current in the city that the master of the 10 Mechanicae had taken for his mistress the most famous whore this side of the Northern Ocean, and that Lunaria Vimian ruled Subrius as if he were a toothless lion, ordering him to this and that, demanding costly gifts, setting him errands, and even in the matter of the bedchamber, herself saying when. Some claimed the story was an invention of Lunaria's, a dangerous game she played with Subris's reputation. Others said that Subris himself had sent the fancy abroad to see if any dared mock him, so he might cut them down with sorcery in some vicious and perverse fashion. But the satchel man had come of the mountain roads to Vame. A stranger, he had never seen Lunaria for himself, nor till tonight the magician lord. "Well?" Subris said drowsily. The satchel man jumped in his skin. "I suggest," Subris said, "you show me this rare treasure beyond wild dreamings. You may mention its origin and how you came by it. You may state its ability, if any, and demonstrate. You may then name your price, but I beg you, no more sales patter." Shivering, the satchel man undid the clasp and drew from the leather a padded bag. From the bag he produced a velvet box. In the box revealed a sapphire glimmer wrapped in feathers. The feathers drifted to the floor as he lifted out a vase of crystal blue, about a foot in length, elongated of neck with a broad base of oddly alternating, swelling and tapering design. The castellated lip was sealed by a stopper that appeared to be a single rose opal. Prudently silent and holding the vase before him like a talisman, the visitor approached Subris's chair. "Charming," Subris said, "but what does it do?" "My lord," the satchel man whispered, "my lord, I can simply recount what it is supposed to have done, and to do, I myself have not the skill to test it." "Then you must tell me immediately how you came by it." "Look at me," Subris added. His voice was all at once no longer indolent, but cool and terrible. Unwilling, but without choice, the satchel man raised his head. Subris was turning a great black ring round and round on his finger. At first it was like a black snake darting in and out, then like a black eye opening and closing. Subra sighed again, depressed at the ease with which most human resistance could be overcome. "Speak now," the satchel man dutifully began. Mesmerized by the black ring, he spoke honestly, without either embroidery or omission. 2. The Satchel Man's Tale. An itinerant scavenger by trade, the Satchel Man had happened on a remote town of the far north and learned of a freakish enterprise taking place in the vicinity. The tomb of an ancient king had been located in the heart of one of the tall, iron-blue crags that towered above the town. Scholars of the town, fascinated by the tomb's antiquity, had hired gangs of workmen to break into the inner chamber and prise off the lid of the sarcophagus. At this event, the Satchel Man was a lurking bystander. He had made up to several of the scholars in the hope of some arcane jewel dropping into his paws. But in the end, all that had been uncovered were dust, stench, decay, and some brown, grinning bones. Clutched in the digits of which was a vase of blue crystal stoppered with a rose opal. The find being solitary, the scholars were obliged to offer it to the town's tyrant. He graciously accepted the vase, attempted to pull out the opal stopper, failed, attempted to smash the vase in order to release the stopper, failed, ordered various pounding devices to crush the vase, which also failed, called for one of the scholars and demanded he investigate the nature of the vase forthwith. This scholar, who had leanings in the sorcerer's direction, had also become the host of the parasitic Satchel Man. The Satchel Man had spun some yarn of ill luck, which the scholar, an unworldly intellectual, credited. So the Satchel Man was informed as to the scholar's magical assaults on the vase. Not that the Satchel Man actually attended the rituals firsthand, but for the mesmerism he would have assured Subrus he had. Yet he was advised of them over supper when the fraught scholar complained of his unsuccess. Then late one night, as the Satchel Man sprawled on a couch with his host's brandy pitcher, a fearsome yell echoed through the house. A second or so later, pale as steamed fish, the scholar stumbled into the room and collapsed, whimpering on the ground. The Satchel Man gallantly revived the scholar with some of his own brandy. The scholar spoke, "It is sorcery of the brink, the abyss. More lethal than the sword and more dreadful, in the hands of a power, what mischief could it not encompass? What mischief it has encompassed." "Have a little more brandy," said the Satchel Man, torn between curiosity, avarice, and nerves. "Say more." The scholar drank deep, grew sousled, and elaborated in such a way that the hairs bristled on the Satchel Man's unclean neck. Searching an antique book, the scholar had discovered an unusual spell of opening. This he had performed, and the rose opal jumped free of the mouth of the vase. Such a whirling had then occurred inside it that the scholar had become alarmed. The crystal seemed full of milk on the boil, and milky lather foamed in the opening of the castellated mouth. In consternation, the scholar had given vent to numerous rhetorical questions such as, "What shall I do?" and "What in the world does this bubbling portend?" Finally, he voiced a rhetorical question that utilized the name of the ancient king. "What can King so-and-so have performed with such an artifact?" Rhetorical questions do not expect answers. But to this question an answer came. No sooner was the king's name uttered than the frothing in the vase erupted outwards. A strand of this froth, proceeding higher than the rest from the vase's mouth, gradually solidified. Within the space of half a minute, there balanced in the atmosphere above the vase, deadly white but perfectly formed, the foot-high figure of a man, lavishly bearded and elaborately clad, a barbaric diadem on his head. With a minute sneer, this figure addressed the scholar. "Normally, further ritual with greater accuracy is required, but since I was the last to enter, and since I have been within a mere 4 centuries, I respond to my name. Well, what do you wish, O absurd and gigantic fool?" A dialogue then ensued, which had to do with the scholar's astonishment and disbelief, and the white midget king's utter irritation at and scorn of the scholar. In the course of this dialogue, however, the nature of the vase was specified. A magician had made it, though when and how was unsure. Its purpose was original, providing the correct magic had been activated by rite and incantation. That done, whoever might die, or whoever might be slain, in the close neighborhood of the vase, their soul would be sucked into the crystal and imprisoned there till the ending of time or at least time as mortal men knew it. Since its creation, countless magicians and others who had learned the relevant sorcery had used the vase in this way, catching inside it the souls or ghosts of enemies, lovers, and kindred for personal solace or entertainment. It might be reckoned, the king casually told the scholar, that 7,000 souls now inhabited the core of the vase. "How is there room for so many?" the scholar cried. The king laughed. "I'm not bound to answer questions. Therefore, I will do no more than assure you that room there is, and to spare." It appeared that whoever could name the vase-trapped ghosts by their exact appellations might call them forth. They might then reply to interrogation, but only if the fancy took them to do so. The scholar, overwhelmed, dithered. At length, the miniature, being demanded leave to return into the vase, which the scholar had weakly granted, he had then flown downstairs to seek comfort from the satchel man. The satchel man was not comforting. He was insistent. The scholar must summon the king's ghost up once again. Positively, the king would be able to tell them where the hoards of his treasure had been buried. For all kings left treasure hoards at death, if not in their tombs, then in some other spot. Was the scholar not a magus? He must recall the ghost and somehow coerce it into malleability, thereby unearthing credible secrets of lore and better cash. The scholar, convinced by the satchel man's persistence and the dregs of the brandy, eventually resummoned the king's ghost. Nothing happened. The scholar and the satchel man strenuously reiterated the summons. Still nothing. It seemed the ghost had been right in hinting that the ritual was important. He had obeyed on the first occasion because his had been the last and knew a soul in the vase, but he had no need to obey further without proper incentive. Then the scholar fell to philosophizing, and the satchel man fell to cursing him. Presently, the scholar turned the satchel man out of his house. That night, while the scholar snored in brandy-pickled slumber, the satchel man regained entry and stole the vase. It was not his first robbery, and his exit was swift from practice. Thereafter he wandered, endeavoring to locate a mage who knew the correct magic to name, draw forth, and browbeat the ghosts in the vase, or even merely to draw out the rose opal stopper with which the scholar did inconsiderably recorked it. Months passed with a mission unaccomplished and despair set in, until the satchel man caught word of the magician lord Subrus. To begin with, the satchel man may have indulged in a dream of enlisting Subrus's aid, but rumor dissuaded him from this notion. In the long run, it seemed safer to sell the vase outright and be rid of the profitless item. If any mage alive could deal with the thing, it was the master of the 10 Mechanicae. And somehow the salesman did not think Subrus would share his knowledge. To accept payment in gold seemed the wisest course. The satchel man came to himself and saw the fire on the wide hearth had changed. It was green now and perfumed with apples. The fire must be the third of the Mechanicae. Subrus had not changed, not at all. "And your price," he gently murmured. His eyes were nearly shut. "Considering the treasure, I forego in giving up the vase to your lordship." The satchel man meant to sound bold, succeeded in a whining tone. "And considering you will never reach that treasure, as you have no power over the vase yourself." Subrus amended and shut his eyes totally from weariness. 7,000 vimi," stated the satchel man curiously, "one for each of the 7,000 ghosts in the vase." Subrus' lids lifted. He stared at the satchel man, and the satchel man felt his joints loosen in horror. Then Subrus smiled. It was the smile of an old man dying of ennui. His mood lightened for a split second by the antics of a beetle on the wall. "That seems," said Subrus, "quite reasonable." One hand moved lazily, and the fourth of the Mechanicae manifested itself. It was a brazen chest which sprang from between the charred rose draperies. Subrus spoke to the chest. A compartment shot out and deposited a paralyzing quantity of gold coins on the rugs at the satchel man's feet. 7,000 vimi," Subrus said. "Count them." "My lord, I would not suppose." "Count them," repeated the magician without emphasis. Anxious not to offend, the satchel man did as he was bid. He was not a particularly far-sighted man. He did not realize how long it would take him. A little over an hour later, fingers numb, eyes watering, and spine unpleasantly locked, He slunk into the mechanical cage and was borne back to the surface. This time his guts were left plastered to the lowermost floors of the hollow hill, musically clinking and in terror lest he himself should be robbed. The satchel man limped hurriedly away through the starry and beautiful night. 3. Proving the vase. The fire burned warmly black and smelled of musk and ambergris. This was the aspect of the fire which Subrus used to recall Lunaria to him. The idea of her threaded his muscles, his very bones, with an elusive excitement not quite sexual, not quite pleasing, not quite explicable. In this mood, he did not even visualize Lunaria Vimian as a woman or as any sort of object. Abstract, her memory possessed him and folded him round with an intoxicating, though distant and scarcely recognizable, agony. It was quite true that she, of the entire city of Vaym, defied him. She asked him continually for gifts, but she would not accept money or jewels. She wanted the benefits of his status as a magician, so he gave her a rose which endlessly bloomed, gloves that changed color and material, a ring that could detect the lies of others, and whistles thinly to their discomfort. He collected sorceress trinkets and brought them for gold to give to her. In response to these gifts, Lunaria Vaymian admitted Subrus to her couch, but she also dallied with other men. Twice she had shut her doors to the master of the 10 Mechanicae. Once, when he had smitten the doors wide, she had said to him, "Do I anger you, Lord? Kill me then. But if you lie with me against my will, I warn you, mighty Subrus, it will be poor sport." On various occasions, she had publicly mocked him, struck him in the face, reviled his aptitude both for magic and love. Witnesses had trembled. Subrus's inaction surprised and misled them. They reckoned him besotted with a lovely harlot and wondered at it, that he found her so indispensable he must accept her whims and never rebuke her for them. In fact, Lunaria was indispensable to the magician lord, but not after the general interpretation. Her skin was like that dark brown spice called cinnamon, her eyes the darker shade of malt. On this somberness was superimposed a blanching of blonde hair, streaked gold by sunlight and artifice in equal measure. Beautiful she was, but not much more beautiful than several women who had cast themselves at the feet of Subrus, abject and yielding. Indeed, the entire metropolis and hinterland of Vaym knew and surrendered to him. All powerful and all feared, and with women who beheld his handsomeness and guessed at his intellect, all worshipped, all that saved by Lunaria. Hence her value. She was the challenge he might otherwise find in no person or sphere, the natural and the supernatural he could control, but not her. She was not abject nor easy. She did not yield. The exacerbation of her defiance quickened him and gave him a purpose, an excuse for his life in which everything else might be won at a word. But this self-analysis he concealed from himself with considerable cunning. He experienced only the pangs of her rejection and scorn, and winced as he savored them like sour wine. Obsessed, he gazed at the vase of blue crystal and pondered the toys of magic he had given her formerly. The vase. The stopper of rose opal had already been removed by one of the spells of the 4X foremen, a copy of which ancient book, there were but 3 copies on earth, was the property of Subrus. At this spell, written in gold leaf on sheets of black bull's hide, Subrus had barely glanced. His knowledge was vast and his sorcerer's vocabulary extensive. The stopper leapt from the neck of the vase. Subrus caught it and set it by his side. Inside the crystal, there commenced the foaming and lathering which the scholar described to the satchel man. At Subrus's other hand lay a second tome. No exact copies of this book existed, for it was the task of each individual mage to compile his own version, the general title of such a compendium being Tabulus Mortem, Lists of the Dead. From these lists, Subrus had selected 70 names, 1/100th portion of the number of souls said to be trapped in the vase. They were accordingly names of those who had died in peculiar circumstances, and in an aura of shadow, such as might indicate the nearness at that time of the soul-snaring crystal, and of someone who could operate its magic. With each name there obtained attendant rituals of appeasement, summoning, and other things that might apply when wishing to contact the dead. All were subtly different from each other, however similar seeming to the uneducated eye. The fire sank on the hearth now paled, and began to smell of incense and moist rank soil. Subris had performed the correct ritual and called the first name. He omitted from it the five inflections that would extend the summons beyond the world, since his intent was centered on the trapped ghosts of the vase. He had also discarded the name of the king from whose tomb the vase had been taken. Occult theory suggested that such a spirit, having been recently obedient to an inaccurate summons, such as the scholar's, could thereby increase its resistance to obeying any other summons for some while after. So the name Subris named was a fresh one, nor, though the ritual was perfect, was it answered. The soul, then, had never been encaged in the vase. Subris erased the name from his selection and commenced the ritual for a second name. In vain, it was midnight, and over the hill above the magician's subiculum, the configurations of midnight were jeweled out in stars. Subris spoke the 19th name and was answered. The moistureless foam clouds gathered and overspilled the vase. White bubbles and curlicues expanded on the air. From their mist flowed up a slender strand, unlike the rest, which proceeded to form a recognizable shape. Presently a foot-high figurine balanced on the air just over the castellated lip of the vase. It was a warrior, like an intricately sculpted chess piece, whose detail was intriguing on such a scale. The minute links of the mail, the chiseled cat that crouched on the helm, the sword like a woman's pin, and all of it matte white as chalk. "I am here," the warrior cried in bell-like miniature tones. "What do you want of me? Tell me how you came to be imprisoned in the crystal. My city was at war with another. The enemy took me in battle, and strove to gain by torture knowledge of a way our defenses might be breached. When I would say nothing, a magician entered. He worked spells behind the screen. Then I was slain, and my ghost sucked into the vase. Next moment, the magician summoned me forth, and they asked me again, and I told them everything." "So," Subris remarked, "what you would not betray as a man, you revealed carelessly once you were a spirit?" "Exactly." "Which was as the magician had foretold." "Why? Because you were embittered at your psychic capture?" "Not at all. But once within, human beings ceased to matter to me. All loyalties of the world, its creeds, yearnings, and antipathies. These foibles are as dreams to those of us who dwell in the vase." "Dwell? Is there room, then, inside that little sphere to dwell?" "It would amaze you," said the warrior. "No, but you may describe it. That is not normally one of the questions mortals ask when they summon us. They demand directions to our sepulchres, and ways to break in and come on our hoarded gold, or what hereditary defects afflict our line, in order that they may harm our descendants. Or they command us to carry out deeds of malevolence, to creep in small hidden areas and steal for them, or to frighten the nervous by our appearance. You have not replied to my question. Nor can I. The interior of this tiny vase houses 7,000 souls. To explain its microcosmic structure in mortal terms, even to one of the mighty magician lords, would be as impossible as to describe color to the stone blind or music to the stone deaf. But you are content," said Subris. The warrior laughed flamboyantly. "I am." "You may return," said Subris, and uttered the dismissing incantation. Subris progressed to a 20th name. A 21st, a 22nd, the 23rd answered. This time a white philosopher stood in the air, his head meekly bowed, his sequined eyes whitely gleaming with the arrogance of great learning. "Tell me how you came to be imprisoned in the crystal." "A tyrant acquired this vase and its spell. He feared me and the teachings I imparted to his people. I was burned alive, the spell activated, and my ghost entered the vase. Thereafter the tyrant would call me forth and try to force me to enact degrading tricks to titillate him. But though we who inhabit the vase must respond to a summons, we need not obey otherwise. The tyrant waxed disappointed. He attempted to smash the vase. At length he went mad. The next man who called me forth wished only to hear my philosophies, but I related gibberish, which troubled him. Describe the interior of the vase." "I refuse. You understand my arts are of the kind which can retain you here as long as I desire." "I understand. I pine, but still refuse." "Go then," and Subris uttered again the dismissing incantation. It was past 3 o'clock. Although six white apparitions had evolved from the blue vase, Subris had reached the 40th name, selected from the tabulus mortem. He was almost too weary to speak it. The atmosphere was feverish and heavy with rituals observed and magics pronounced. Subris's thin and beautiful hands shook slightly with fatigue, and his beautiful face had grown more skull-like. To these trivialities he was almost immune, though exhaustion heightened his world-sated gravity. He said the 40th name and the figure of a marvelous woman rose from the vase. "Your death," he asked her. She had been an empress in her day. "My lover was slain. I had no wish to live, but the man who brought me poison brought also this vase under his cloak. When my soul was snared, he carried the vase to distant lands. He would call me up in the houses of lords and bid me dance for his patrons. I did this, for it amused me. He received much gold. Then one night in a prince's palace, I lost interest in the jest. The prince appropriated the vase. When I begged leave to rest, the prince recited the incantation of dismissal, which the whipped man had revealed. Ironically, the prince was not comparably adept at the phrases of summoning, and could never draw me forth again." The woman smiled and touched at the white hair which streamed about her white robe. "Surely you missed the gorgeous mode of your earthly state," Subra said. "Not at all." "Your prison suits you then?" "Wonderfully well." "Describe it." "Others have told me you asked a description of them." "None obliged me. Will you?" But the woman only smiled. Broodingly, Subris effected her dismissal. He pushed the further names aside, and taking up the stopper of rose opal, replaced it in the vase, the fermentation stilled within. Slowly the fire reproduced the darkness and scents that recalled Lunaria for the magician. The vase was proven and ready. The promise of such a thing would flatter even Lunaria. She had toys before, but this, perverse, oblique, its potential elusive but limitless, it resembled Lunaria herself. As the brazen bell clocks of Vame struck the fourth hour of black morning, an iron bird with black eyes, fifth of the Mechanicae, flew to the balconied windows of Lunaria's house. The house stood at the crest of a hanging garden on the eastern bank of the river. Here Lunaria, honoring her name, made bright the dark, turning night into day with lamplight, singing drums, harps, and rattles. Her golden windows could be seen from miles off. "There is Lunaria's house," insomniacs, or later broad thieves, would say, chuckling, envious, and disturbed. An odor of flowers and roast meats and uncorked wines floated over the spot, and sometimes firecrackers exploded, saffron, cinnabar, and snow above the roof and walls. But after sunrise, the windows turned gray, and the walls held silence, as if the house had burnt itself out during the night. The iron bird rapped a pane with its beak. Lunaria, heavy-eyed, opened her window. She was not astonished or dismayed. She had seen the bird before. "My master asks when he may visit you." Lunaria frowned. "He knows my fee, a gift. He will pay. Let it be something unheard of and unsafe." "It is. Tomorrow, then, at sunset." 4. Lunaria of Vame. The sinking sun bobbed like a blazing boat on the river. Water and horizon had become a luminous scarlet stippled with collar and tangerine. A fraction higher than the tallest towers of Vame, this holocaust gave way to a dense mulberry afterglow, next to a denser blue, and finally in the east a strange hollow black, littered with stars. Such a combination of colors and gems in the apparel of man or woman, or in any room of a house, would have been dubious, but in the infallible and faultless sky, were lovely beyond belief and almost beyond bearing. Nevertheless, the sunset's beauty was lost on Subris, or rather, alleviated, dulled. At a finger snap almost, he could command the illusion of such a sunset, or possibly a more glorious one. It could not therefore impress or stimulate him, even though he rode directly through its red and mulberry radiance, on the back of a dragon of brass, the sixth of the Mechanicae. The dragon was equipped with seat and jeweled harness, and with two enormous wings that beat regularly up and down in a noise of metal hinges and slashed air. It caught the last light and glittered like a fleck of the sun itself. In Vame, presumably citizens pointed between admiration and terror. A servant beat frantically on the door of Lunaria's bedchamber. "Lady, he is here!" "Who?" Lunaria inquired sleepily from within. "The Lord Subris," cried the servant, plainly appalled at her forgetfulness. On the terrace before the house, the dragon alighted. Subris stilled it with a single word of power. He stepped from the jeweled harness and contemplated the length of the hanging garden. Trees precariously leaned over under their mass of unpicked fruit. The jets of fountains pierced shadowy basins that in turn overflowed into more shadowy depths beneath. Trellis night flowers were opening and giving up their scent. In Lunaria's garden, no day flowers bloomed and no man could walk. Sometimes the gardeners crawling about the slanted cliff of the hanging garden to tend the growth and the watercourses fell to their deaths on the thoroughfare 80 feet below. The only entrance to the house was through a secret door at the garden's foot, of whose location Lunaria informed her clients, or from the sky. The servant ran onto the terrace and cast himself on his knees. "My lady is not yet ready, but she bids you enter." The servant was sallow with fear. Subra stepped through the terrace doors and beheld a richly clad man in maddened flight down a stairway. Lunaria had kept one of her customers late in order that Subra could see him. This was but a variation on a theme she had played before. Near the stairfoot, about to rush to a new flight for these stairs, passed right the way to the interior side of the secret door. The customer paused and looked up in a spasm of anguish. "You have nothing to dread from me, sir," Subris remarked, but the man went on with his escape, gabbling in distress. "Am I not to dread you?" Subris moved about, and there Lunaria Vaiman stood, dressed in a vermilion gown that complemented one aspect of the sunset sky, her blonde hair powdered with crushed guilt. She stared at Subris boldly. When he did not speak, she nodded contemptuously at the dining room. "I am not proud," she announced. "I will take my fee at dinner. I am certain you will grant me that interim between my previous visitor and yourself." The red faded on gold salvers and crystal goblets. Lunaria was wealthy, and she had earned Erivime. They did not converse, she and her guest. Behind a screen, magicians performed love songs with wild and savage rhythms. Servitors came and went with skillfully prepared dishes. Lunaria selected morsels from many plates, but ate frugally. Subris touched nothing. Indeed, no one alive could remember ever having seen him eat or raise more than a token cups to his lips. Occasionally, Lunaria talked as if to a third person. For example, "How solemn the magician is tonight, though more solemn or less than when he came here before, I cannot say." Subris never took his eyes from her. He sat motionless, wonderful, awful, and quite frozen, like some exquisite graveyard moth crucified by a pin. "Are you dead?" Lunaria said to him at length. "Come, do not grieve. I will always be yours, for a price." At that he stirred. He placed the casket on the table between them, murmured something. The casket was gone. The vase of blue crystal glimmered softly in the glow of the young candles. Lunaria tapped the screen with a silver wand, and the musicians left off their music. In the quiet, they might be heard, scrambling thankfully away into the house. Lunaria and the magician were alone together with sorcery. "Well," Lunaria said, "there was a tale in the city today, a blue vase in which thousands of souls are trapped, souls which can inform of fabulous treasures and unholy deeds of the past, courtesans who will reveal wicked erotica from antique courts, devotees of decadent sciences, geniuses who will create new books and new inventions, if they can be correctly persuaded, providing one can call them by name." "I could teach you the method," Subra said. "Teach me." "And so by a night of your life," Subra smiled. It was a melancholy, though torpid smile. "I mean to have more than that." "A week of nights for such a gift," Lunaria said swiftly. Her eyes were wide now. "You shall have them. Yes, I shall, and more than those." He got up from his chair and now walked around the table. He halted behind Lunaria's chair, and when she would have risen, lightly he rested his long fingers against her throat. She did not try to move again. The scents of ambergris and musk floated from her hair. His obsession, the gnawing and only motive for his existence, obscuring from himself his true desire, the pang of her indifference, her challenge. He saw the road before him, the box in which he might lock her up. Physically, he had possessed her frequently. Such possession no longer mattered. Possession of mind, of emotion, of soul, had become everything. The joy of actual possession, the intriguing misery of never being able to actually possess her again, and his fingers tightened about the contours of her neck. She did not struggle. "What will you do?" she whispered. Presently remove the stopper of the vase. It is already primed to receive another ghost. Whoever expires now in its close vicinity will be drawn in, into that microcosm where 7,000 souls dwell content. That enchanted world, they come forth haughtily and retreat gladly. It must be curious and fine. Perhaps you will be happy there. I never knew you to lie previously, Lunaria said. You said the vase was a gift for me. It is. It will be your new home, your eternal home, I imagine. She relaxed in his grip and said no more. She remained some while like this in a sort of limbo before she was aware that his hands, rather than blotting out her consciousness, had unaccountably slackened. Suddenly, to her bewilderment, Subrus let her go. He went away from her, about the table once more, and stopped, confronting the vase from a different vantage. An extraordinary expression had ranged his face. Am I blind? He said, so low she hardly made him out. Youth, and of all things panic, seemed swirling up from the darkened closets behind his eyes, and with those an intoxication such as Lunaria had witnessed in him the first night he had seen her, the first night she had refused him. She rose and said sternly, "Will you not finish murdering me, my lord?" He glanced at her. She was startled. He viewed her with a novel and courteous indifference. Lunaria shrank. What an ultimate threat had not accomplished, this indifference could. "I was mistaken," he said. "I have been too long gazing at leaves and missed the tree." "No," she said, "wait," as he walked towards the terrace doors, where the brazen dragon grew vague and greenish in a damson twilight. "Wait? No, there is no more need of waiting." The vase was in his hand. Sapphire flashed and then went out as the dusk enclosed him. The dragon heaved itself with brass creakings, upright and abruptly aloft. Lunaria, rooted to the ground, watched Subrus vanish into the sky above Vame. 5. In solitude. Somewhere in the hollow hill, a lion roared. It was a beast of jointed electrum, the 7th of the Mechanicae, activated and set loose by Subrus on his return. Its task, to roam the chasm of the hill, a fierce guardian, should any ever come there in the future, which was unlikely. It was unlikely because Subrus, descending, had closed and sealed off the entrance to the hill by the use of the 8th mechanism. The stone pavilion had folded and collapsed in unbroken and impenetrable slabs above the place. The periodic, inexhaustible roar of the lion from below was an added, really unnecessary deterrent. And now Subrus sat in his darkened hall, in his quartz chair. The fire did not burn. One lamp on a bronze tripod lit up the vase of blue crystal on a small table. The stopper lay beside it, and beside that a narrow phial, with a fluid in it the color of clear water. Subrus picked up the phial, uncorked and leisurely drained it, had the taste of wine and aloes. It was the most deadly of the 6 deadly poisons known on earth, but its nickname was gentleness, for it slew without pain and in gradual, tactful, not unpleasant stages. Subrus rested in the chair, composed, and took the rose opal stopper in his hand and fixed his look on the vase. He had exhausted the possibilities of the world long since. His intellect and body both were sick with the sparse fare they must subsist on. There was no height he might not scale at a step, no ocean he might not dredge at a blink, no learning he had not devoured, no game he had not played. Thus it had needed Lunaria to hold his horrified tedium in check, something so common and so ugly as a harlot sneer to keep him vital and alive. When the gate had opened, he had not seen it. He had nearly bypassed it altogether. He had sought a gift for Lunaria, then he had sought to trap her in the crystal, making her irrevocably his property and denying himself of her forever. Lunaria. He scarcely recalled her now. Concentration on the minor issue had obscured the major. At the last instant, the truth had come to him, barely in time. He had exhausted the world. Therefore he must find a second world of which he knew nothing, a world whose magic he had yet to learn, a world alien and unexplored, a world impossible to imagine, the microcosm within the vase. Like a warm sleep, gentleness stole over him. Primed to catch his ghost, the blue vase enigmatically waited. Perhaps nightmare crouched inside, perhaps a paradise. Even as a poison chilled it, Subrus's blood raced with a heady excitement. he had not felt for 2 decades and more. In the shadows, a silver bell clock struck a single dim note. It was the 9th of the Mechanicae, striking to mark the hour of the magician lord's death, and Subrus sensed the moment of death come to him, as surely as he might gauge the supreme moment of love. He leaned forward to poise the rose opal stopper above the lip of the vase. As the breath of life coursed from him, and the soul with it unseen was dashed into the trap of the crystal, the stopper dropped from his fingers to shut the gate behind him. Subrus, to whom existence had become mechanical, the 10th of his own Mechanicae, sat dead in his chair. And in the vase, what? Lunaria Vimen had climbed the hill alone. Below, at the hill's foot, uneasily 3 or 4 attendants huddled about a gilded palanquin, disheveled by cool winds and somber fancies. Lunaria wore black, and her bright hair was veiled in black. She regarded the fallen stone of the pavilion. Her eyes were angry. "It is foolish of me," she said, "to chide you that you used me. Many have done so. Foolish also to desire to curse you, for you are proof against my ill-wishing, as finally you were proof against my allure. But how I hate you, as I love you, as I hated and I loved you from the beginning, knowing there was but one way by which I could retain your interest in me, for knowing that I should lose you in the end, whatever my tricks, and so I have." Leaves were blowing from the woods in the wind like yellow papers. Lunaria watched them settle over the stone. "A 1,000 falsehoods," she said, "a 1,000 pretenses. Men are compelled to visit me. How afraid they were of the magician lord, only that you might behold them. Gifts I demanded, poses I upheld, to mask my love, to keep your attention, and all now for nothing. I would have been your ghost slave, gladly. I would have let you slay me and bind me in that vase. I would have." The electrum lion roared somewhere beneath her feet in the hollow hill. "There it is," Lunaria muttered sullenly, "the voice of my fury and my pain that will hurt me till I die. My despair, but more adequately expressed. I need say nothing while the other says it for me." And she went away down the hill, through the blowing leaves and the blowing of her veil, and never spoke again as long as she lived.